This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, November 15th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Israeli airstrikes in Gaza continue for a second day as Hamas's military wing returns rocket fire into Israel. Lawmakers and residents make a push to protect social safety programs as President Obama prepares to meet with congressional leaders to discuss budget cuts. And California launches a program where polluters can buy carbon credits. Supporters say it's designed to reduce greenhouse gases.
California hopes to show other states and the rest of the country that first of all, cap and trade can work.
Those stories and more coming up after these headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today, the Justice Department announced a criminal settlement with BP for the 2010 explosion at the Deepwater Horizon oil platform in the Gulf of Mexico. That disaster killed 11 people and sent more than 200 million gallons of oil gushing into the Gulf. Attorney General Eric Holder announced the settlement in Louisiana.
This marks both the largest single criminal fine, more than $1.25 billion, and the largest total criminal resolution, $4 billion, in the history of the United States.
FSRN's Zoe Sullivan reports from New Orleans.
Under the announced settlement with the Department of Justice, BP will pay $4 billion over a five-year period. Under the settlement, the company will plead guilty to 11 felony counts relating to the deaths of Deepwater Horizon's crew. It will also plead guilty to misdemeanors under federal environmental laws like the Clean Water Act. The company has agreed to take an additional felony for lying to Congress about the amount of oil leaking into the Gulf. Much of the money from the settlement will go to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and the National Academy of Sciences. In addition, two monitors, one looking at safety, the other at company ethics, will be appointed to follow the company for 4 years. A judge still has to approve the final criminal settlement. Activists were removed from a hearing last week in New Orleans when the civil settlement was being discussed. A spokesperson for the Gulf Restoration Network, an environmental advocacy group, told FSRN the plea deal does not cover environmental damages, but says BP admitting to criminal misconduct bolsters the Department of Justice's efforts to pursue maximum civil fines, approximately $20 billion, for gross negligence under the Clean Water Act. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
The exchange of fire continues between Israel and Gaza-based Hamas forces today. The fighting was triggered yesterday when the Israeli military assassinated a top Hamas military official in a drone strike. Hamas vowed retaliation. Overnight, Hamas fired hundreds of rockets from Gaza into Israeli territory. Three people are reported dead. Israel continued attacks on Gaza as well. At least 15 have died. Israel says it dropped leaflets on Gaza warning residents to stay away from Hamas operatives and facilities to avoid crossfire. The military is also waging a social media campaign to garner international support for the action, posting in English, French, and Spanish, as well as directly addressing the people of the U.S. The international hacker group Anonymous says it has taken down more than 40 Israeli websites denouncing the country's threats to cut off internet service to Gaza.
To the people of Gaza and the occupied territories, know that Anonymous stands with you in this fight. We will do everything in our power to hinder the evil forces of the IDF arrayed against you. We will use all our resources to make certain you stay connected to the internet and remain able to transmit your experiences to the world.
Already, people are mobilizing. Emergency actions are planned in dozens of cities around the world. FSRN's reporter in Israel says a protest against the violence is happening tonight in Jerusalem. Adam Keller, with the Israeli peace group Gush Shalom, says local media has been flooded with news of the attacks.
You hear very much about the suffering of the people in the southern communities of Israel, which is real, but you hear nearly nothing about the suffering of people in Gaza, which is much worse.
The international community is weighing in, with the U.S. condemning Hamas's rocket fire into Israel. In contrast, Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi says Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip are unacceptable and warns that the Israeli offensive might lead to widening instability. Morsi is scheduled to visit Gaza tomorrow. FSRN's Noel King reports from Cairo.
Morsi spoke to U.S. President Barack Obama on Wednesday, hours after Egypt summoned home its ambassador to Israel. In a statement, the White House reiterated U.S. support for Israel's right to self-defense while urging Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to make every effort to avoid civilian casualties. The growing conflict presents the U.S. president with the first substantial diplomatic challenge of his second term. The U.S. has long relied on Egypt to keep a cold peace with Israel, while Egypt relies on billions of American dollars each year to fund its military. But Egypt's political alliances shifted dramatically with the ouster of Hosni Mubarak in 2011. Mohamed Morsi, the first democratically elected Egyptian president in decades, was a high-ranking member of the Muslim Brotherhood, which has close ties to Hamas. The U.S. calls Hamas a terrorist group. In Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood called for demonstrations in support of Hamas, and Egyptian authorities opened a border crossing between Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula so that injured Gazans could seek medical help. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
And finally, China's new government is now in place after being appointed today during the Communist Party Congress. As expected, Xi Jinping will take over as the party's general secretary, the highest position in the government. International media is characterizing the new leaders as part of the older conservative political establishment, not expected to challenge the status quo. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Israeli attacks against the Gaza Strip continued unabated for the second day in a row. The Israeli military escalation followed a targeted airstrike on the vehicle of a top Hamas military leader in Gaza City yesterday, claiming his life and that of his escort. The widespread attacks, mainly airstrikes, have killed at least 15 Palestinians, including children, and injured more than 150. Armed factions in Gaza have responded with rocket fire. In one attack, three Israeli civilians were killed and an infant critically wounded, according to the Israeli military. As violence continues, many Gazans are worried about a repeat of the 2009 war. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
In central Gaza Strip, dozens of vehicles and scores of residents gather around a petrol station on the outskirts of Al Buraid refugee camp. They want to make sure they have enough fuel to run their cars and power generators amidst fears that Israeli attacks on Gaza will continue. Abu Isa is a local taxi driver from the nearby Al Nusayrat refugee camp.
I have been driving since the early morning to look for fuel for my car at all the patrol stations here in the central Gaza until I found fuel here at this station. And I have been waiting about 2 hours now.
Since Israel's assassination Wednesday of Hamas military leader Ahmed al-Jabari and subsequent airstrikes that have killed civilians, movement of residents across Gaza has notably decreased. Many are afraid to be in the streets and spent a long night listening to bombs explode in their neighborhoods. Government and UNRWA-run schools in the territory are closed due to the emergency situation. But local authorities assured Gaza's 1.6 million residents not to worry about stockpiling goods or commodities. Ahmad al-Banna is the owner of a bakery in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza Strip. His bakery produces 7,000 pita breads per hour, and he says he can work unabated for about 15 days.
Residents' consumption of bread has doubled recently, compared with previous normal times. Something that has caused some sort of confusion for bakeries. I can assure you that there are no problems. Everything is available, such as wheat, gasoline, and cooking gas.
Violence in Gaza began last Thursday when explosives went off near an Israeli armored vehicle in the southeastern Gaza border area of Khan Yunis. One Israeli soldier was lightly injured. Israeli army attacks that followed, which killed Ahmed Abu Dakka, a 13-year-old boy who was playing football around his family home, about 1 mile away from the borderline. تغريد أبو دكة is the boy's 20-year-old sister.
What I want to say is, why are such children killed? Why has Ahmed been killed? My message to the Israeli army is, do whatever you want, but at the end of the day, you will go away, because your end seems to be near, God willing.
A number of other Palestinian youth were killed last weekend. The current spate of Israeli attacks over the last 28 hours are the most intense since Israel's last war on the region in 2009. For the past 3 years, some small Gaza-based armed factions continued to fire homemade rockets into nearby Israeli areas, while Israel used to attack the region frequently. Israel's military assault comes as Hamas had reached a tentative ceasefire agreement with Israel via Egyptian mediators. Dr. Naji Shurab is a Gaza-based political analyst. He hopes the violence will come to an end in a few days.
This time's truce will be different from previous truce declarations. I believe there will be some conditions and guarantees for both sides, including regional, international guarantees, mainly a greater role by European and Egyptian mediators. Also, I believe that Hamas will be given a bigger role as a political player. Despite the fact that the current military is short-lived, it will bring about new changes, such as a Palestinian reconciliation.
Israel says it is determined to continue or even expand attacks on the Gaza Strip until Israel's main objective of stopping homemade rocket fire into Israel is achieved. In the past 24 hours, Hamas and other Gaza-based factions have fired more than 200 rockets, including Grad missiles, into nearby Israeli areas, leaving 3 Israelis dead and a number of others injured. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
In Washington, D.C., President Obama is holding meetings this week with CEOs from top corporations, union representatives, and Republican and Democratic leaders in Congress as efforts intensify to resolve the year-end tax break expirations and spending cuts some are calling the fiscal cliff. Prompted by anxiety over a bipartisan deal that would slash the social safety net, progressive groups and lawmakers are holding their own meeting today on Capitol Hill, demanding that programs for the elderly and poor take precedence over tax cuts for the rich. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
In a packed hearing room on Capitol Hill, representatives from the House and Senate joined local activists to draw the line on how the upcoming budget and tax problems are solved. At the Summit to Defend Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, D.C. resident Tanja Harding said these programs should be expanded, not cut.
Well, I did office work, but that's the office work I do. I can't sit for a matter of long period of time any longer because of issues with my body, whatever. But not only that, though, I feel like if you paid in for something, you're still not getting what you paid in for to live on. So if they cut the little bit people are getting, they can't even survive all what they're getting already. So why cut it?
Harding and several others at the summit expressed concern that the president would agree to cut these programs as part of a deal to reduce the deficit and avoid what some call the fiscal cliff. That term, which many progressive lawmakers criticize as misleading, refers to the end of this year, when the Bush tax cuts for everyone are set to expire, and deep automatic cuts to the military and domestic budget go into effect. Those cuts were triggered when the bipartisan supercommittee failed to agree on a deficit reduction plan earlier this year. Speaking on the House floor Thursday, California Democrat Barbara Lee predicted that Republicans will stall negotiations in order to make Democrats agree to an unpopular last-minute deal out of desperation. But she warned the American people won't allow that to happen.
What they don't want is for our country to be rushed into urgent budget decisions by the false threat of a so-called fiscal cliff. This economic and political gridlock is just another political cliff created by the hostage-taking obstructionism of the Tea Party-controlled Congress.
Lee, a member of the Progressive and Out-of-Poverty caucuses, said the fiscal cliff is a manufactured crisis to distract lawmakers from addressing more pressing issues, including poverty, joblessness, and homelessness.
The real cliff is that anyone is facing today is a human cliff, that far too many American families are standing on the edge as I speak. If we don't strengthen our economy for all Americans, millions will be cut off from the only lifeline keeping them from falling off that human cliff and into poverty, and that's unemployment compensation. Mr. Speaker, we face many challenges, but we must not allow our political crisis to create an economic crisis for millions of Americans who are struggling.
Republicans in the House and Senate, as well as corporate-backed outside groups like the Campaign to Fix the Debt, have said they will demand an extension of all of the Bush tax cuts. On the House floor on Thursday, Tennessee Republican Diane Black summarized the party's position.
With more than 23 million Americans struggling to find work, that is not the time to be raising taxes on anyone, period.
Black praised Obama for already extending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy one time and urged him to do it again. She advocated for reducing the deficit through what she called entitlement reform. But some local activists like Tanja Harding say proposals like this will only help those at the top, not the majority of Americans. She told FSRN elected officials who have never experienced poverty themselves don't understand the importance of the social safety net.
You saying that now because everything's all gravy right now in a sense, because you're working, you got that great income coming in, but just lo and behold, something stops and you actually need some assistance, then you're going to feel it. And it's until you walk in someone's shoes, you can't bear to understand what they're going through.
The organizers of Thursday's summit say they'll soon launch a national campaign to pressure the president to defend funding for programs that seniors, the sick, and the poor depend on. President Obama will begin negotiations with the leaders of the Republican and Democratic parties on Friday. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Join Free Speech Radio News on Friday, November 23rd, for a special program, Rising Tides, Rising Voices, Climate Change and the New Reality.
And those emissions are destroying the planet, and you see it in China, and you see it in El Salvador, and you see it in Peru, and now you see it in New York.
We're beginning to see some opening up in terms of disclosure about what is really going on, about how much resources are being taken, how much is being spent. So there's hope that things will begin to change.
We are all aware that time is ticking, and we are quickly running out.
Rising Tides, Rising Voices, Climate Change and the New Reality, a special half-hour program. That's Friday, November 23rd, here on FSRN. Next week, California companies that emit high levels of pollution will find out if they won permits under the state's new cap-and-trade program. The Air Resources Board held an auction Wednesday in which companies bid online for carbon allowances, which could determine how much a particular company emits and at what cost. It's the most comprehensive cap-and-trade program in the nation and is central to the state's 2006 AB 32 law, which mandates a 30% cut to greenhouse gas emissions by 2020 and 80% by 2050. The auction went forward after a last-minute legal challenge by the California Chamber of Commerce failed to block it. While the program has been called a model for other regions, some environmentalists criticize the cap-and-trade model and instead call for a focus on low-carbon and carbon-free energy. Kara Horowitz is executive director of the Emmett Center on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. She joins us to discuss the cap-and-trade program. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks so much for having me.
The California Air Resource Board says that the auction will set the price for carbon allowances in which companies can buy and sell these carbon credits. How exactly will this work?
It'll work something like this. California businesses have to report at the end of each year, covered businesses, that is, which at this stage include basically electric utilities and very large industrial facilities, have to report at the end of each year how much carbon pollution they've emitted, and they have to acquire allowances, which are creations of this cap-and-trade program. They have to acquire allowances and submit them to the state to cover the amount of their emissions. There's a total cap on the number of allowances that are out there in the world that California has created, and that cap serves as the restriction to ensure that the overall number of emissions by these covered businesses stays within certain levels.
And as you mentioned, right now it covers certain industries. Is it going to extend to others?
Yeah, so right now it covers, as I said, electric utilities, so power plants and power providers, and very large industrial facilities, those with a certain number of tons of emissions per year. In 2015, the program expands a bit to also include distributors of transportation, natural gas, and other fuels.
And to break this down to some basic units here, one allowance allows the release of 1 metric ton of carbon dioxide. So what is going to be decided after this auction?
So this auction is the first of the auctions where California puts these allowances out into the world. People can bid for the allowances, regulated entities, and any other folks, any other traders or others who want to get involved in the auction can if they've registered with California. They bid for the allowances, and that provides a nice price signal, economists tell us, to regulated entities about how much these allowances are worth.
And at this point, that covers businesses, industries based within the state of California.
Yeah, that's right. Only California entities are covered by the cap and trade program.
There's also been criticism of the model of cap and trade in general. The argument is that as long as fossil-based energy is much cheaper, that it's hard to compete and progress on reducing emissions will be slow. Some have called instead for public investment in clean energy. How does that fit into this latest development in the cap and trade program in California?
Yeah, I actually think that's an argument in favor of cap and trade. So the function of a cap and trade program like this is to help, again, I'll quote our economist friends, is to help internalize the cost of carbon into fossil fuels. One of the reasons that traditional fossil fuels are relatively cheap, too cheap in the view of economists and environmentalists, is because they have to impose all of these external costs in terms of cost for public health, cost to coastal communities because of sea level rise, all of these other costs that come from climate change and other ills that are created by fossil fuels. But the costs that are created by fossil fuels aren't reflected in the price paid for those fossil fuels. So a cap and trade system operates somewhat similar to a carbon tax in that it helps to recast the price of these fuels to better take account of their cost to the economy, to neighborhoods, to public health.
But to pursue that a moment further, doesn't that mean that if companies that are based on a fossil fuel economy, if they have resources and revenue, they could essentially, through the cap and trade program, continue to pollute in certain ways by acquiring these credits?
Yeah, and that again is actually one of the advantages of a cap and trade program over, say, a carbon tax. If you put a tax on carbon, firms that have enough money and are willing to spend it can, I'll just say pollute, let's just call it pollute when you put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, can pollute to their heart's content as long as they're willing to pay the tax. With a cap and trade program, there's actually a hard limit, a cap in the cap and trade program on the total amount of allowances available. And that translates into a hard limit on the total amount of greenhouse gas pollution that can be put into the atmosphere by regulated businesses.
Carol Horowitz is Executive Director of the Emmett Center on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
The student strike that shook the Canadian province of Quebec wrapped up in September with the election of a new government that canceled a proposed tuition hike. Still, hundreds of students and residents of Montreal live with criminal charges, injuries from police attacks, and trauma related to the strike. Several student federations and civil rights groups in Quebec have renewed their call for a public inquiry into police repression during what became known as the Maple Spring. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has the story from Montreal.
There have been several calls for a public inquiry since the new Quebec government of Pauline Marois was elected in September, but so far there has been no response. A coalition of groups calling for an investigation into police tactics and political repression, including Amnesty International and all the major Quebec student federations, is now demanding a meeting with the premier. Members of these groups, who say they represent tens of thousands of people, say that if a public inquiry isn't held, the new government and police are doomed to repeat the repression. The Quebec student strike lasted from February to September, the longest in Canadian history. At its peak, over 300,000 students refused to attend classes and participated in the largest mass demonstrations that this country has ever seen. Over the course of the strike, police forces made over 3,500 arrests in student demonstrations, oftentimes employing a kettling tactic to encircle and arrest up to 500 people at a time. Kevin Sutton, a Montreal resident who was criminally charged during a student demonstration, spoke to FSRN about his arrest in June.
I was riding my bicycle beside the demonstration, and I was just kind of observing what was happening, and eventually I noticed that certain police officers were stopping to look at me a little longer, and then I noticed all of a sudden that the group of police that's had been following the demonstrations for a while, which are I call the Snatch Squad, and I noticed that half of them suddenly ran ahead and the other half turned around to look at me.
Sutton says the police weren't just looking at him, but staring.
And that's when I realized that they were after me. And so I rode away on my bicycle. And as I was riding, eventually I was deciding which way to go. And all of a sudden a white van pulled up and I tried to turn around. And I wasn't able to catch speed on my bicycle, and instead the officers ran up and grabbed me and pulled me off my bike.
Since September, about 50 different organizations in Quebec have joined the call for a public inquiry into police tactics and repression. Dominique Péchard, the president of the Ligue des Droits et Libertés, a civil rights group that launched the call, explains the need for such an inquiry.
Some people have been brutalized, either beaten or the use of chemical agents, tear gas and so on. And there have been use of dangerous weapons like sound grenades and plastic bullets. And some people have been seriously injured. One person has lost an eye and so on. So there have been a series of violations of rights, which are quite serious. And we want a public inquiry because there is no mechanism in Quebec presently to force the police to account for the way they acted.
According to a media relations officer with the Montreal Police, the force has no comment on the call for an investigation. Even though the student strike ended in September, the issues surrounding it remain in the Quebec media landscape. In recent weeks, the former spokesperson for the student federation ASSE and one of the most public figures of the student movement was found guilty of being in contempt of court. Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois encouraged students to continue their strike despite a court injunction ordering students back to class. Jeremy Bedard-Vine, the current spokesperson for ASSE, commented on the judgment.
Well, we're hoping that it will not set a precedent for spokespersons of social movements being prosecuted for defending democracy. He spoke for all of us back then when he said that students should take the means to enforce the strike mandates taken democratically in General Assemblies. And I think many have repeated those words in solidarity with Gabriel. He should not be prosecuted for defending the democracy of the General Assemblies.
Nadeau-Dubois' conviction is now under appeal. The call for a public inquiry in Quebec comes at the same time as the global education strike, a week of internationally coordinated actions for accessible education taking place from November 14th to the 22nd in at least 14 different countries. And in Quebec, even though many students are celebrating their successful defeat of the tuition hikes, student groups are anxiously awaiting the government's planned summit on education, due to take place in early 2013. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.